we go ahead and get started, I'd like to welcome you all today to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thank you for coming. A special warm welcome to our honored guest, His Excellency Nana Akufo-Addo. My name is Mark Bellamy. I'm a senior fellow here at CSIS in the Africa program, and we are very pleased to be co-sponsoring this event today with the U.S. Institute of Peace. And I want to thank my colleague Raymond Gilpin and his colleagues at USIP for their initiative in creating this opportunity for a dialogue this afternoon. Ghana has not captured a great many headlines in the U.S. news in recent weeks, and on balance, that's probably not a bad thing. That's probably a good sign when too much of the news coming out of Africa in recent days and recent weeks has concerned tragedies in Sudan, Somalia, Zimbabwe, and elsewhere. Ghana has been building its own quiet story, a very positive story, for some time now, almost a decade on now, by building a record that some have characterized as a success story, as an African success story, an economic success story, perhaps more importantly, a political success story. And no one is perhaps better situated to comment on whether that is in fact the case, and if so, how we account for it, than our special guest today, Nana Akufo-Addo. We would like to proceed with remarks, followed by questions and answers. We have about a little over an hour, hopefully an hour and a half. My job really in that case is to get out of the way and to ask my colleague Raymond Gilpin to give a proper and complete introduction of our special guest. Before doing that, I just want to acknowledge that we have a distinguished Ghanaian delegation with us today. I want to thank Ambassador Edise for being here and for bringing his team with him. Raymond?
Thank you very much, Mark, and thank you to CSIS for co-hosting this event with us. We're very pleased to be here. The nexus between economic governance, stability, and political progress is one that's very, very well acknowledged, but not very well understood. And today we hope that we're going to take the debate and the discussion that much further during this event. But before making an introduction, I'd just like to acknowledge a few people. Reva Levingston is somewhere at the back. She was very instrumental in bringing this all together and making sure the logistics worked. Reva, if you'll just wave at the back so people know who you are. Dorina Biko, who works at the United States Institute of Peace, a colleague, and she's with the Conflict Prevention Bureau. Dorina is somewhere at the back. And also acknowledge Catherine Morris and Sheila Mwandi, who are also in the audience. As Ambassador Bellamy rightly pointed out, we are very, very fortunate to have someone who straddles many worlds. And by straddling many worlds, he brings many unique perspectives to this issue. His complete bio is available in the folders, I believe. But talking to him just prior to this meeting was very disarming because he said, I'd like it to be as informal as possible. So I'm just going to give you a very informal version of what is a very stellar career. As I said, he straddles many worlds. He straddles the private sector and the public sector. In the private sector, he's been a business person, he's been a journalist, he's been a lawyer. We wouldn't hold the lawyer bit against him. In the public sector, he's been a member of parliament and he's been a foreign minister. And in many ways, particularly when he chaired the UN Security Council, he was Africa's ambassador. It is with great pride we tune into C-SPAN to see him steer those very, very thorny discussions. Academically, he has degrees in politics, law, and in economics, and that's why I forgave him the lawyer bit, because he's a like-minded economist like myself. And he has had a broad range of experience, not just in Ghana, but in the African region and worldwide. That is why it is with great pride and anticipation we invite him to the podium to make his remarks, and which will focus on Ghana's experience and both national and regional implications. So without much ado, join me in welcoming His Excellency Nana Addo Akufo-Addo.
Thank you very much. Mr. Director, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I have to thank the organizers of this afternoon for the opportunity they're giving us to be able to engage with you, to talk about Ghana and its future. We're the first country in sub-Saharan Africa to have gained independence. And that fact is one which is very much part of our assets in the eyes of Ghanaians. It's something that we keep referring to, because in some ways, of course, it distinguishes us. The experience of our nation since then up till now has been a really mixed bag, beginning with Westminster-type political arrangements. Very soon after independence, our nation fell into the trap which became prevalent all over Africa. Authoritarian rule began with a one-party state, and after that, a series of military interventions in our national political life. And you know what that means. We had, therefore, military dictators of one sort or another. That was the cycle for nearly 40 years after independence. This country that began with so much hope, people, 1957, there's even this famous editorial of the Times of London, sometime late March of 1957, that compared the newly independent Ghana in West Africa with Korea, who had then also become independent in Asia. And the Times editorial said that if you looked at the two countries, the quality of education, the engagement, the political culture of the two countries. You put all of those things together, you would ask on whom would you put your money for future success? You would have to choose Ghana. Well, I don't know where the author of the editorial is, but he proved to have been spectacularly wrong. Korea then took the path that it did, which has seen it as one of the major industrial countries of the world. And Ghana went down and down and down. The last 15 years has been the effort that the Ghanaian people have made finally to reverse this process of decline. Begin, therefore, to rebuild our country, and rebuild it first and foremost as a democracy. Because the issue of one-man rule in Ghana from the very beginning of our independence had provoked a great deal of agitation. And it is only today now that we live in a country where free speech is guaranteed, not just by the Constitution, but by the culture, the political culture of our country, where people are in a position to engage in all aspects of our public discourse without fear of intimidation, without fear of reprisal. We're seeing in that process already a much higher quality of governance on the part of those who have been democratically elected. And it is normal, because if people have the freedom to criticize, freedom of the airwaves, freedom of the print media, they will raise questions that are bound to enhance the quality of government in a given state. Ghana is no exception. So that much of what I'm going to say has that as the background of a nation that has emerged from decades of authoritarian rule, that is now trying to build itself as a free state, as a state where the rule of law matters and where human rights are respected. The immediate consequence of this has been a significant improvement and the economic performance of our country. I'll give you two or three basic facts. The time when the soldiers left office, the Ghanaian GDP was less than $4 billion. Today, a decade further on, under the government of John Ajikun Kufo, our president, we're talking about a $15 billion GDP. You're looking at rates of growth, which were less than 4% during virtually the entire period of the PNDC and DC era. And today we are now becoming accustomed to 6% rates of growth of our GDP. Poverty statistics in our country have also taken a dramatic turn for the better. We're told, these are UN statistics, they're not mine, that in 1992, you could say that 40% of the Ghanaian people lived below the poverty level. The figure 15 years later is a figure of some 28%. These are still horrendous figures, but clearly you can see that there is a definite push forward. In my view, that has a great deal to do with the democratic environment in which we're now working. For years, there were these sterile debates in left-wing circles in Africa about democracy versus development, and development versus democracy. A lot of pen and paper, lots of words were used to suggest why democracy was an impediment to development, why it was all of that. I thought it was a great deal of specious reasoning, because at the end of the day, you talk about the development. You talk about the development of human beings. I don't consider myself a situation whereby you are a gilded, well-fed slave in a cage as necessarily an improvement on my human condition. I think the development of a human being, being well-fed is important, but the capacity also to express yourself and be able to be yourself in terms of other people is equally important. And that debate, fortunately for all of us, has ended in the defeat of those who said that democracy was a barrier to development. There's a great deal of authoritarian government in Africa in the early days was supported by this type of rationalization. The African people would not be able to accept multi-party democratic government. It would breed ethnic parties, and it would accentuate tribalism. It would be there as an impediment to the building of the nation state. It would make it difficult to take the hard decisions that are required to be taken in order to free our people from poverty, etc., etc. Most of those became self-serving arguments for a whole generation of dictators, both civilian and military, to perpetuate one-man rule on our various countries. Ghana was no different. Fortunately, the lie has been exposed. And it is now becoming increasingly clear, not just in Ghana, but in the rest of the continent, that indeed the framework of free government is indispensable to the development of our societies. I don't believe it is an accident that the most developed countries in the world are the democratic states of the globe. I don't think that it is an accident. I think that there's a direct connection, a direct nexus between high state of development and, of course, the maturity of their democratic processes. And Ghana, in evolution, is a clear microcosm of the truth of that. Obviously, the greater the prosperity, the more substantial and firmer rooted the democratic engagement. I'm not saying that it will be possible for you to sustain democracy for long periods if the mass of the people continue to be désespéré, miserable, have no opportunities, no hope. That always, inevitably, everywhere in the world, it breeds revolution. Seen it here in the history of Western Europe, in America, as well as on the African continent. So the necessity for us to ensure that not only do we have democratic institutions on the ground, but that also we have models of economic development that are going to deliver prosperity to the mass of our people. In the context of our country, economic progress in Ghana is not going to be possible so long as Ghana continues to be mainly a raw material producing economy. 70% of our national receipts come from the production and export of raw materials, cocoa, gold, and timber. I don't know of any country in the world where prosperity has been built on the basis of a raw material producing economy. All the economies in the world that have gone forward and been able to bring prosperity to the mass of their citizens are economies that are industrial economies of one sort or another, but certainly economies where the value addition and economic activity is absolutely critical. So that democratic engagement in Ghana is going to be very much more solid if we are able to undertake the structural transformation of the Ghanaian economy, so that that economy then can have a greater and greater opportunity to be able to address the concerns of jobs, of employment, poor wages, etc. And that trajectory is one we need to move on as quickly as possible. The world as it is beginning to emerge is going to be very difficult for global order and security. We have a handful of countries which are rich in one corner of the world and the rest of humanity suffering across the globe. That is not a prescription for order and for stability in the affairs of man. Clearly, if this globalized economy is going to make sense for all of us as citizens of it, this so-called global village is going to make sense for all of us who are inhabitants of it, then all of us have to have a stake in the material prosperity that the globalized economy is meant to deliver. If we are going to be able to participate in it, then the issue is the type of economic system that would allow us to prosper. The difficulties for us, which perhaps were not there for those who have developed in earlier decades. Today, the rules of world trade and engagement make it difficult for you to put up big tariff barriers, to go do a whole lot of things that the earlier economies were able to do and fortify themselves. But nevertheless, if you read the fine print well enough, I think it is still possible for us to devise a strategy of economic development that accentuates local production, local industry, local self-reliance. In our country today, manufacturing, which is such a key component of any progressive developed economy, represents 10% of our total national output. It's a low figure. It's 3-4 times that in the industrializing nations of Asia. Ours is 10%. The general average in Africa is about something in the region of 15%. So all those things that we need to do to incentivize manufacturing output and development are critical to the whole fight, the whole strategy against poverty in our countries. We in Ghana are fixing our eyes on the fiscal incentives that we can give, establishing funds which people, especially small and medium scale enterprises, can access, trying to clean up the regulatory environment in our country, strengthening the regulatory agencies. For instance, a major challenge to the economies of Ghana and of virtually the whole of the African continent are this invasion that is taking place from Asia. Many, many occasions, we're finding our countries being the dumping ground for goods that ought not necessarily to be allowed into our country. But because the regulatory framework, regulatory agencies that are meant to lead the fight against dumping are weak, we find it difficult to be able to stop. But our critical areas for us that we're going to have to look at to ensure that indeed we will also be able to have the space that will allow our industries the opportunity also to grow. There is no possibility for us to be able to address problems of acute unemployment if indeed we are the recipients, we have to import everything that we want to consume. All that means is that other people are working for us, and our own workforce then is idle. We're going to take a very, very hard look at the agricultural commodities that we turn out, how we can add value to them. For instance, in cocoa, just 30% of our cocoa is processed locally. The figures for countries like Brazil and Malaysia are much, much higher. We are going to have to make an effort to reach those figures. The target we have set ourselves is that at the end of the first term of our new government, hopefully the government under me, we will arrive at a figure of some 70%, move from 30% to 70% of the processing of our cocoa. We're called the Gold Coast and have been for centuries a major producer of gold, and yet we don't have a gold refinery in our country. The oil is produced and refined elsewhere. That has to be an important focus of our future policy, how we can make sure that we can do something about the gold in Ghana so that the value, we're told that it's something like 10% of the value of the gold is what we receive by virtue of being the raw material producer, so that at least we can get higher on the value chain by having a refinery in Ghana. We have bauxite deposits in Ghana that are exported from our country raw. These are all areas that we're now looking at very critically to see whether we can mobilize the resources to ensure that they are done at home. Fortunately for us, because of very prudent economic measures that have been taken these last 6 or 7 years, the confidence of the investor community in Ghana is growing all the time. In the whole period, 1982, right up to the year 2000, which is the period of military and quasi-military rule in Ghana, foreign direct investment in Ghana did not exceed $2 billion. In the last 7 years of democratic engagement in Ghana, it is a figure of $8 billion. For the first time in our history, we've been able to go to the private capital markets of the world to raise money. We came last year, we went to raise $750 million for infrastructural development, private capital, without the intercession of the World Bank or the IMF. It turned out that the financial community had much greater confidence in us than we did ourselves. The bond issue, the sovereign bond issue, was oversubscribed to the tune of $3.2 billion. So that the measures that have been taken to stabilize the Ghanaian economy and also to develop the institutional structures of democratic governance in our country are now sending out very positive signals to the private capital markets of the world that Ghana indeed is a country in which you can take a long-term position and invest in. So for the first time in our history, we're now going to have access to the pool of savings that is outside Ghana and Africa to finance our development. We've had another important discovery in our country, which will help this process, industrial accumulation. That is the oil. When we came into office, the company that was responsible for exploring for oil, the Ghana National Petroleum Corporation, was doing everything other than exploring for oil. They were investing in fish farms, telecommunication companies. There was even an unserviceable rig that they were trying to rent around the place, everything other than the core activity. Our government repositioned it to focus on its core activity. And predictably, the results have paid off. Last year, an American-led consortium broke the news to us that oil of very significant commercial quantities had been found in our western shores. Not only were the quantities themselves significant, but the quality of the oil was also very high. The mahogany apparently has properties superior to Bonny Light. So you're then talking about some of the sweetest crude in the world. So here, too, is another source of significant revenues that are now going to be available for us to make the structural transformation that I've been talking about. It's being estimated that in the first 5 years of the production of the oil, beginning in the year 2010, when it's supposed to start going, we're looking at a revenue stream of something approximately $15 billion. The Ghanaian economy has never seen such revenues before. So we are now having to think through the set of measures that would allow us to absorb this kind of money and use it well. Clearly, fundamental precondition is that the money are managed in a transparent and accountable manner. If we are not to go down the road, I don't want to mention names here, there are fellow Africans here, of some of the countries on our continent where oil has been found, and we're determined not to go down that road. The whole process of transparency and accountability in the management of the revenues are critical. Our intention to bring an Act of Parliament into where the manner in which the oil revenues will be handled, will be dealt with to the knowledge of the Ghanaian people. The Parliament itself will intervene on the matter, and we will then be able to see exactly every penny where it flows. Secondly, that the areas where the oil has been found are seen to be primary beneficiaries of this new wealth. Because, I mean, Delta is right next door to us. We have seen what has happened there. We don't want a repetition of that in Ghana. And that therefore means that the western region, where the oil has been found, has to have, if you like, the first charge on the use of the money. And then thirdly, mobilization of the human capital. If indeed these monies are going to be to the benefit of our people and our country, we have to make sure that Ghanaians are at the center of the management of these resources, that we have the human beings that have the skill and the quality to be able to manage this new industry. So these are the considerations for us. We're working on them, and we believe that by the time the oil begins to flow, our country will be well positioned to be able to take the advantage from it that we should. That instead of being a curse, the discovery of oil in Ghana is going to be a blessing for the Ghanaian people. I think that the picture that I'm drawing is a picture of a country now that it's feeling the full effects of freedom. We're seeing the energies of our people really galvanized and mobilized on the issue of development. There are other important developments that have taken place in Ghana that are anchoring this, especially in the social sector. The World Bank, with the military government, had devised a system of health care for us, which they called cash and carry. They were concerned about the large subsidies that were going to subsidize public health in our country. Great deal of those subsidies were ill-spent, corruptly used, etc. And therefore, came a policy that was meant to cut out the subsidy and its mismanagement. They called cash and carry. Got into hospital. First question that the nurse or the doctor was asked, do you have the money for the treatment? Because if you don't, they're not entitled to look at you. We thought that this system of healthcare was not only not befitting the dignity of our people, but it was also inhumane. So we have replaced it with an insurance scheme. which has already covered more than 50% of the population. And the target is that by the end of the year 2010, the entire Ghanaian population will have been covered by the insurance system. And it's meaning that for very little sums of money, people can access healthcare system that is increasingly more and more, has increasingly greater and greater quality. Because together with it are also the measures that are being taken to stem the brain drain. We've established a postgraduate college of medicine in Ghana. Many of our healthcare professionals, it is through that route that they would leave our country. They would go abroad to seek specialization and further education. Then, of course, never come back. Now we have a college of physicians and surgeons in Accra that is in a position to give that postgraduate training. Already we can see the impact of that on the exodus of healthcare professionals from Ghana. And together with the insurance scheme, it has some teething problems, but by and large it is working well. We're then beginning to be able to deliver a decent healthcare system for the ordinary people of our country. Again, and another area of great concern is education. We have seen from the examples of the Asian countries that the development agenda can't be properly confronted when you've got a mass of people who are illiterate as your labor force. And that the vast sums of money, the great investment that was made in spreading primary education to all is an example we have to follow in Ghana. When we came into office, we had been told that the public finances of our country did not make it possible for us to respect the constitutional injunction that education at the primary school level should be free. But the better management of our public finances has now made it possible for us to subsidize primary school education in Ghana. It's something we call the capitation grant, which are given, which is in lieu of fees paid by parents, are sponsored by the state. So essentially, primary school education in Ghana is free. Predictably, it has done some things. Firstly, the numbers of people who are now being enrolled in primary school have gone up by 30% over the last 3 years. The dramatic figures. Beyond the absolute numbers, when you look at inside the figures themselves, are some very important data. We're seeing that 50% of this increase is coming from people who would not otherwise not have gone to school, the ages of 9 to 13. If you're going to primary school for the first year at the age of 10, it shows quite clearly that you were never going to go but for the introduction of the policy. And on top of it, 50% are coming from the areas of the most disadvantaged areas in our country, the three northern areas of Ghana. You can see directly the impact that this is having on those of bringing people more and more into the system of education and thereby making it possible for us, in reasonably short time, to have a literate work. We're able to reach that. And I believe that the process that we are means that within the next decade, instead of having 60% literacy, which is what we have in Ghana, we will then have 100% literacy in Ghana. And we can see the implications of that for the national development effort. So many different areas of our national life, we can see this improvement that is taking place because we now are operating in a free environment in Ghana. Open society. The institutions of our government are long conventional lines that you recognize. The separation of powers between the executive, the judiciary, and the legislature. And these particular institutions are all beginning to perform better and better, largely because of the scrutiny that is on them by the people of Ghana. So I'm very clear in my mind about the nexus between democratic governance and economic growth. I think that Ghana is a very good example of the validity of that nexus. I believe that the example of Ghana, too, is an example that is going to have a very important impact on the rest of the continent. Please don't, I don't want you to misunderstand me to think that everything is milk and honey in Ghana. It certainly is not. We have considerable difficulties and challenges. We have serious problems of poverty that we are confronting. But I'm painting a picture of a situation in movement, and therefore where we see ourselves going. And if we succeed in December and continuing down this path of democratic engagement, being able to organize elections, again, that are transparent and free, whose results are easily acceptable by the population, it would mean that really we have arrived as a functioning, viable, democratic state, where elections become a normal part of our lives, and that the opportunities, therefore, for a society in where individual freedom and initiative are the mainsprings of economic activity, will have that society. I keep saying that those who say that they have seen the Asian tigers, the African lions are coming. And Ghana is going to be in the lead of all of them. Thank you very much.
Well, let's open up the floor then to questions. Let me just ask that I should have mentioned earlier that all cell phones should have been silenced by this time. And those of you wishing to ask a question, I think we have microphones here. Please just briefly introduce yourself, and we'll take a couple of questions and we'll proceed from there. Like, Minister, you've answered all the questions.
Oh, that's very
already
good.
On there. Peter?
Thank you. Peter Lewis from Johns Hopkins University. Ghana, no doubt, has been seriously affected by the sudden and dramatic increase in food prices. What is your perspective on the challenge, and what can be done to deal with it?
I think the obvious challenge, of course, is for our agriculture, that the dependence that for far too long we've had on imported food, it's clear to us that we have to do something about it. We have the land, we have the people. Now it is that we have to put the things together to be able to enhance agricultural productivity in Ghana and be able to be much more self-reliant the production of our own food, i.e. food security. That's a major challenge that has come out of all of this. And the responses that we're getting inside the country suggest that people are fully aware that that is the way that we have to go. I think that we have been a little dilatory in Ghana in coming to grips with things like why we have to import so much rice and wheat, etc., when in fact we're capable of growing these things ourselves. The whole northern sector of our country, tremendous savanna land, very, 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 very adaptable for large-scale agricultural activity. That has to be the thrust. We have to use this crisis as a challenge for us to think more clearly about our future and how we can guarantee food security for ourselves. That has been the response of the public authorities so far. And hopefully we are going to continue down that road and make a really serious effort to grow our own food. Perhaps it needs crises like this for people to wake up to their real conditions. But otherwise, you're going on the way you do normally. And yes, if you can find the money for the import of this and that. I think that this dramatic increase has now made it clear to us that we have to focus very, very seriously on how to ensure, not just in our country, but throughout our region. Because of the impact of this in the regional context, you can well imagine the smuggling of food and the rest of it from one place to another, depending on the prices that are being paid. So it's a matter that we're going to have to deal with, not just at the national level, but we're also going to have to deal with it within the regional context as well, to be able to make sure that there is genuine food security for us. I believe that that is the way we're thinking, and hopefully it will have its consequences in action.
Uzadim Maiwala, I'm just a student at Columbia University. But thank you very much, Your Excellency, first of all, for your speech. I just wanted to know sort of what your thoughts on AFRICOM were and your... and sort of the impact you think it's going to have on West Africa and sort of energy security and all of that, if you could.
For Africa.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, first of all, the issue of security in our continent ought to be our own matter. Yes, we should be able to organize ourselves to protect our own security, national, regional, and continental. The fact that that hasn't happened is what has led others, for their own reasons, to make their own arrangements for security. The AU worked and agreed that the continent divided into five, central, southern, east, west, northern, would attempt in each part of the continent to establish its own regional security force, which at the continental level would link up to provide us with a continental force. As always, these things are done in our part. They're there on paper. But actually, realizing them becomes a difficulty. We, for instance, in Ghana, offered to be the fulcrum of the West African regional standby force. As we've been, as you know, involved extensively in peacekeeping operations for a very long time. So we believe we have a certain expertise, if you want to call it that, in handling security issues, especially outside Ghana, the regional, continental, international forces. That offer has not been taken up. ECOWAS pushes, but the individual states find it difficult to live up to their undertakings. And it is in that context that things like the American initiative come. We can protest, oppose it, but until we ourselves have our own arrangements in place, much of our protests will be just words in the air. So those are the matters on which we need to focus, because a second 21st century scramble for the continent, for its resources, especially its oil resources, I think you can imagine the consequences of that for our independence, etc. So the clarion call has to be to all of us that we should wake up and begin to take the decisions, medium to long term, that will guarantee our self-sufficiency, our security, and our independence. Other people are not going to take those decisions for us. They will take decisions for their own interests. And properly, I have no problem with that at all.
I'm Reed Kramer from allafrica.com. I wanted to ask you to take the question of oil revenues a little bit further. You outlined some prescriptions for dealing with this influx. They don't sound that different from what I've heard from other governments. They sound good. But I'm wondering if this plan is further developed than what you've said in your speech, or if it's something you're still working on as part of and plan to have in place when when you take office if you are successful in December. So the question is, oil, it takes a lot to deal with the kind of massive increase in revenue that you've referred to. Could you tell us a little bit more about what you have in mind?
I mean, first of all, I think that the environment in which the oil discoveries have been made in Ghana is significant, and it's significantly different from these other countries that you're talking about. It has not come, the oil didn't come in Ghana in the time of the soldiers, who have always felt themselves unaccountable in Ghana, like everywhere else in the world. The Nigerian example is that it came in the time of the soldiers in Nigeria. In our time, it's coming at a time where of the greatest openness that we've ever had in our society. So already, for me, that's an important check and balance, the fact that it is taking place within this democratic atmosphere in Ghana. As I said, we intend to bring an act of parliament that will set up the whole system. The president has already established an interministerial task force in Accra that is working out the global as well as the specific details of our oil policy. But I have an idea of the general thrust of it. Have a separate oil revenue account, which will be separate from the consolidated account, the central accounts of the state. We're going to get a situation where the parliament will be given regular reports on the state of that account. And then arrive at some acceptable formulae for the distribution of the money. That amount that goes to the future, that amount that goes into supporting our infrastructure, our education, our health system, and also, of course, the interests of the local people. But it is that general framework that we're talking about, and that is going to be fleshed out by a specific act of parliament, by legislation. Of course, the legislation come up, people, the system is set up. That's not the end of the matter. If the citizenry is not vigilant about wanting to protect the legislation also could be just a dead letter. With that, we're involved in the whole process of how civil society responds in any given state. But I'm very confident that in Ghana, we're going to get a beneficial and an intelligent way of dealing with this oil revenues. People are already up in arms making all kinds of suggestions at home. I don't think anybody is going to be allowed to get away with dealing with the oil in any old way. I don't believe that that's going to be the case in Ghana.
Okay, back here. Your Excellency, my name is Kobina Idu, and I'm a Ghanaian. And since this is the first time I've had the privilege to be this close to you, I'd like to first of all thank you for your efforts in fighting for the freedoms that we have today as Ghanaians. And secondly, I have a question that has been bugging me for a long time, and that is, whose job is harder, the President of the United States or the President of Ghana?
Oh, wow. Neither. So hopefully we'll take a rain check on that question. And we can ask, hopefully in a year's time, I'll be able to come and give you an answer.
Hi, I'm Samuel Adeni Jones. I work for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. You mentioned the history of Ghana. And I remember when we were all students in Europe. I think we were in Europe around the same time. Ghana occupied a very critical and important position in the hearts of Africans. Even though you mentioned the period of Kwame Nkrumah, the Sajifo, there were some failures as a period of authoritarian rule. There was a pride that Africans had in Ghana at that time. My question is, what do you see as you move forward, the role of Ghana in Africa? I think it was also important that last year when President Kofor was chairman of AU, we celebrated the 50th anniversary. And it brought back memories. In fact, there was a time when we used to say if you had problems in Europe, you went to the Ghanaian embassy. If you were an African, any African went to the Ghanaian embassy. So just I wanted you to expand on the what you see as Ghana's role in the future of Africa.
I think that what we can do best is to try and do the best for ourselves. And hopefully that by the example of good governance in Ghana, of good social policy, and seeing to it that the economy develops as rapidly as possible so that jobs can be addressed for the young people in our country, we provide. I mean, already, for instance, an important initiative of our government, the National Youth Employment Scheme, is now being duplicated elsewhere in West Africa. The Ivorians are now looking at it very seriously to replicate it, and I hear that even Mali is also beginning to look at it. So I think that that's it. It's not so much to proclaim for ourselves some messianic or role, but to make sure that is what we are doing at home is the best that we can. And if it succeeds, like it looks like it is succeeding, then other people will see that this is the way forward for their development and that they will get the benefits that we are also beginning to get out of it. That's the way I would like. I think that the Ghana, the messianic role that Kwame Nkrumah had for us, well, it was okay in 1960, but I think that today it doesn't make so much sense. But certainly we can play a constructive role if we are also conducting ourselves in an intelligent and efficient manner.
Thank you. My name is Aaron Rose. I'm a venture capitalist based in Seattle, Washington. I want to talk maybe a little about investment in Ghana. I know some of my colleagues on the West Coast have been investing in your country and spoke highly of it. The question, in fact, we met in Seattle last week about investing in Africa, and questions come up. And I wonder if you could shed some light. You mentioned about the regional issues facing Ghana. Where do you see your country role in resolving this issues or mitigating its effects on your country? That's one question. The other question is the comparative advantage of Ghana. How do you plan to sustain that advantage in the near future? And probably the last question is, what is your vision? You mentioned manufacturing is at 10%. What's your vision as the opportunity for investors, and what's the near-term opportunity, and what's your long-term vision of what role Ghana will have as a larger and stronger economic center within the African region?
The regional issues. I mean, initially, the most important regional issues have been about security, peace and stability. And we've had the ECOWAS framework since 1975, this community, and what is called the Economic Community of West African States, that was working for the conventional regional goals, a customs union. Within it, the traders we want. Basically also to work towards a common currency to facilitate transactions and doing business within the region. Having free movement of goods and services, capital goods and services. These were the standard objectives of the. But then, because of the various conflicts that took place since the founding of ECOWAS, the energies of ECOWAS became more concentrated on trying to resolve these regional issues of peace and security. And I think it's quite rightly so, because how are you going to be investing money in countries which are conducting civil war, etc.? So that has been the focus of the energies of the regional organizations. And so far, ECOWAS, for instance, has been doing a good job. Where we've had difficulties, which is now has to be the next focus, is in making the economic issues on a regional basis really effective. Having a genuine customs union. Nigeria, the biggest market in West Africa, has put out 72 items from our country that it has banned from being able to be imported into Nigeria. These are not measures that assist the process of regional integration. We're engaged with the Nigerians in talking about it and finding a solution. That if really the regional integration agenda is going to be meaningful, then Nigeria has to be the one also to show the way forward. So that and then the establishment of the customs union has not been as successful as we would want it to be. The what is the ETL? The trade liberalization scheme has not been developed as quickly and as extensively as we would like to see, even though we in Ghana have been, quite compliant with the laws and the relations setting up. So you've got a whole panorama of things at the regional level that we're going to have to address. How? By dialogue, by mobilizing with our sympathetic political forces in the various countries in our region to make sure that the idea of ECOWAS, the regional market, we're talking 270 million people at today's figures. It's a significant market. And it has this implication for Ghana. If indeed we can position Ghana in two ways. One, as a financial services center for the region. It's a very important objective of ours, because the circumstances in our country make it possible. The geographic location of Ghana, we have a whole lot of banks that are establishing the regional headquarters in Ghana. We even have got the whole principle of offshore banking beginning in Ghana, that we can work towards making Ghana the region's financial center, and also the center for light manufacturing activities. We have this market out there. People are importing things from Europe and Asia. We can make those same things in Ghana. But then we need to work out these matters, the customs thing, the currency. We have, in West Africa, as you know, 8 countries of the 15 of ECOWAS who are, they call UEMOA, that is the countries that are tied to the Banque de France, the Francophone countries, who have the CFA currency. The others have different types of currency. We're trying to make sure that they also, as soon as possible, develop a common currency, the ECO, it's called. Today's target is for it to be in being by 2009, the end of 2009. I don't know to what extent that is really feasible, because the various convergence criteria of the various states are still at significant disparities. I don't know to what extent. Every year we renegotiate the delivery date. Let's see how it goes. But those are the decisions that we're having to try to take and get our colleagues and brothers and states in Africa, in West Africa, to join us with. But that would be where we are looking at. We're positioning ourselves as the gateway to the region. The fact that so much of the business of the world is done in English to us is a matter of some advantage, because that's our language. This Francophone Sea, but we are in English. We're right there in the center of West Africa. I think if we put all of those things down, we're a friendly country, hardworking people, prepared to learn and all of that, we can position Ghana intelligently as a financial services center and also as a center for light manufacturing activities. One or two more, then we have to move.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Give me your card.
Yes, first of all, Nana Michiawo, and I'd like to say welcome.
Thank you.
I'd like to say welcome to you, as well as the Ghanaians and Africans and friends of Africa who are here, who contribute to development. I would like to say I'm very proud to see so many of you here, and I'm very happy to be able to interact with you. First of all, I think that your address, you spoke a lot about the issue of openness, open society, democracy, reforms, interactions with China, with other movers, and of course the role that China has played in development earlier on in terms of Europe and other places. The thing that I've noticed as we have so many Africans, Ghanaians and others who are here, where Ghanaians are able to adapt to many things and to be in many places. But one of the things that I'm interested in is that in terms of this openness, what those things that are quintessentially Ghanaian that need to be preserved for the development of the country. What efforts are being made to make sure that, you know, we can identify that? And also, what is the role of those of us who are in the diaspora, you know, Ghanaians, you know, who are working? What is our role as partners in the development of the country?
I'm here with all of this high-priced Ghanaian material here. I'm going to ask one of them to answer you. Kofi, try and answer.
The United States, that North American continent, starting in Canada and then to the U.S., because predominantly the people we've been meeting are Ghanaians, so it's been a major part of his address. Now, I will quickly summarize. We take serious interest in the contributions and the inputs that Ghanaians abroad can make into our economic development process and rebuilding our nation. He's committed himself to total transformation of the Ghanaian economy, taking cognizance of what the last government, this government has done, the foundation that has been laid to really erect the infrastructure that will transform Ghanaian society. Many of Ghanaians living abroad have been exposed to Western ways of doing business, have gained tremendous insights into how economies work, ITC, or ICT, and science and technology that we will need to move our country to the next level. What we intend to do quickly is to provide an avenue that encourages you to come back home, provide incentive that allows you to become reintegrated into society to help you resettle and make the transition less difficult. Many of us, including himself, he lived in Europe for quite some time before coming back. I live in this country. My colleagues have, many of us have lived in this country before we went back. We went through a very difficult adjustment process. His job and all of us who have had this experience is to ensure that the transition will be less painful and be most useful so that you can come home and help build a better Ghana. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Nana, welcome to Washington. As one of your constituents from JV, I want to say a special welcome. I have two questions. One is Zimbabwe. I want to hear your views on how the continent has handled Zimbabwe. Do you think there's something more that could have been done? And where do we go from here? Then on a personal level, I want to hear your thoughts on President Kufuor's decision to nominate John Mills, your opponent, in December for the highest national award. I'm very interested in that question.
First one was what? I forgot.
Zimbabwe.
About Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe is, I think, is a complex matter for all of us Africans. I mean, because there are several things that we're having to look at. First of all, of course, the human rights issues. Issues of democratic engagement in Zimbabwe. Then, also, the equally significant issue of the historic injustice, the land issue. And these are all sort of intertwined. And that's what's making the response in Zimbabwe so difficult, especially for the neighbors. Because the situation of a handful of people owning all the, virtually the 60-70% of the land of a country, that one is a no-go in any country. The methods that are being used perhaps to deal with it may not be the best. But there is a significant and very important historic matter there that all of us as Africans have to confront. And at the same time, too, we're witnessing these human rights abuses on the continent. Unfortunately, I think that because these two matters have been intertwined, it has made it difficult for the leaders of the continent to speak out with the force and the openness perhaps that they should be. That's why Becky and the others have been talking about constructive, what, diplomacy, engagement, all those terms. It's a bit ironic, because when those terms were used by Chester Crocker to describe the South African situation, he was condemned and chastised all over the world. But I believe these are the issues there. They're not easy issues. But I think that the days when OAU, AU are a club of leaders who just pat each other on the back and don't speak for real about what's going on, increasingly that has to be a matter of the past. and we're going to be called upon to speak out clearer and clearer about each other's matter. We're talking about a peer review process in Africa. That's the genuine peer review. It's not the formal processes you go to at the AU, submitting papers about your economy and your political institutions. But the real peer review is what's going on in Zimbabwe, and that people will engage on it. I'm hoping that increasingly the new atmosphere that is developing in Africa will make it possible for people to speak about this matter and not necessarily be seen to be subverting or being in league with foreign powers and all of that language. The matter of President Kufuor honoring my opponent, I don't have a big problem about that. I don't think that is what is going to determine the election in December. Mm-hmm. I think that the election in December is going to be determined by the people's attitudes towards our two parties, towards our two personalities, what we have to offer as leaders, the records of our party, our projection for the future, what kind of vision that we have for tomorrow's Ghana. I believe that those are the matters. I'm sure it will be a matter for the to the taste of the opposition party to make a great deal of the fact that this man is being honored. I don't have any difficulty with that. People take advantage of everything in politics that they can put their hands on. But I think to believe that that has settled the election in December, I think it's to misunderstand fully what's going on in Ghana.
Good. Okay. I think we'll take one more question in order to respect the minister's schedule, and then Raymond, I think, will offer a few comments. Yes, sir.
Name is Alice Champon, and I'm based here, and I'm trying to gradually disengage back to Ghana, so I'm very much interested in what the Honorable President in Waiting has to say. Those of us who have lived here have observed how the United States elections, people tear themselves apart, and after they are done, they come all together for the sake of the country. I think over the past couple of months, the people in the current government have demonstrated the same level of tolerance as shown by the people who are in front of me here. I want you to talk to us about how, on a national level, you engage the other side to ensure that beyond December 2008, the same common love for country will exist, and therefore some of us can feel safe that we're not going to have another Kenya. Thank you.
I think that Alan Jamating is the best placed person to answer this question.
Excellent delegation.
Well, that's a tough one. But interestingly, just trying to think through what is going on here in the United States, even within the Democratic Party. I mean, I feel convinced that we could probably offer some consultancy services too. As to how to bring parties together after what, obviously, as you are attesting to, was a very competitive primaries process. But that has been our tradition and the hallmark of our party for many years. My two colleagues here were senior cabinet ministers, together with the two of us. We went into the primaries. It was a tough election. And we are all together now supporting, hopefully, the next president of the Republic of Ghana. Now, it's absolutely critical that this is not just a photo opportunity or a showpiece, but you can also understand that for us to invest time and effort to join him, we ourselves are serious about the future of our country. So we mean what we are doing now. But it's also very important that we transfer this same kind of effort and commitment, that if God willing, if we are able to come into power, as you're saying, under the leadership of the candidate now and hopefully the next president, for us to be able to demystify the whole process of governance being a winner-takes-all process. For me, I think that we have absolutely no difficulty in doing this because we've set the path towards showing that when we are in power, we have an all-inclusive attitude. You know, I think during President Kufuor's term of office, he has shown clearly that people in other party, like CPP, they have been part of our cabinet. So I have absolutely no doubt in my mind that our good friend and brother Nana, having been a senior member of cabinet, would do the same thing. But beyond that, it's also a question of not just of personal effort, but it's a question of institutionalizing the process. I mean, if you build institutions of governance and of democracy, then it doesn't really matter what effort him as a leader puts into it. It is the complement of institutions that you put in place that would enable people to feel part of the process of governance. And I believe that will be the path forward that will follow. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll be very brief. I'd just like to put a lot of what we've been hearing and discussing in some context. In 1980, I was privileged to attend the opening of the Organization of African Unity Heads of State meeting in Sierra Leone, which happened to be Mugabe's first OAU meeting as a newly elected or appointed head of state. And one of the things that was really prominent on the agenda in 1980 was regime security. It was the days of the old club, where heads of state and politicians got together to discuss ways to keep themselves in power. Hearing Africa's current leaders talk about economic governance, talk about transparency, talk about the nexus between robust economic management and sociopolitical outcomes, talk about a strategy to enhance resource management and resource allocation down the line, not just for the benefit of a few, but recognizing the importance of more broad-based impact, is in many senses very revolutionary. And I think that as we wish the Honorable candidate all the best, we'll continue to remember his words and watch progress with great anticipation because we are confident that a lot of the things he has shared with us today are not just head knowledge but expressions of intent. And I'm confident that with support from the great people of Ghana and the international community, Ghana would be able to make progress not just, as he has rightly pointed out, for the benefit of Ghanaians, but for the sub-region of West Africa and Africa as a whole. And even globally, Ghana is one of the world's largest contributors to peacekeeping worldwide. And so I'd like to thank His Excellency Nana Akufo-Addo once more. Thank you all for participating, and thank Mark and CSIS for co-hosting this event. Thank you very much.